Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by contributors from community radio stations across Canada. This episode of Groundwire was produced at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, on the traditional territory of the Kininkahagam, and is hosted by myself, Zosha. On today's show...
I think it goes without saying that as long as Canada continues to detain families, it will detain children as well.
It's very clear that a neutral state doesn't discriminate.
But first, here are the headlines. Michael Welsh of CKUW 95.9 FM brings us an update 1 year after Dakota Land Resistance Camp was set on a major tar sands pipeline route.
The month of July 2019 marks the one-year anniversary of Spirit of the Buffalo Camp, erected as an act of resistance against the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline project. The project entails replacing an existing tar sands pipeline originating in Hardisty, Alberta, and transitioning through the prairies to cross the U.S. border near the Manitoba town of Gretna. That crossing point is where Spirit of the Buffalo Camp is located. Dakota land defender Geraldine McManus, who created the camp, explains that she feels both protected by the ancestors and support from allies near and far. However, she has also experienced significant trials and challenges dealing with the elements, including some unfriendly locals.
It's one thing for people to be upset and yell at me and whatnot. Okay, I can handle that, but not destroying my property out there, not, you know, going in and writing, you know, messages, go home in my wood and killing animals and throwing them inside my wigwam. And those kind of things I won't tolerate.
The Spirit of the Buffalo Camp has evolved over the past 12 months. Geraldine McManus sees the site functioning as an environmental injustice learning hub, educating visitors on some of the current and ongoing assaults on Mother Earth and the need to play a role in healing her. For Groundwire, this is CKUW's Michael Welch.
CKUW broadcasts in so-called Winnipeg, or occupied Anishinaabeg Akin, the homeland of the Métis, and the historical territory of the Nihiawak and the Nakota. CJLY, on Sinik's traditional territory in BC, brings us news on the online Fossil Power Top 50 Corporate Mapping Project, released earlier this month. CJLY's Catherine Fisher reports on the project, which is led by the University of Victoria, Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and the Parkland Institute.
The Corporate Mapping Project, a partnership of academic and community-based researchers and advisors, has just released its Fossil Power Top 50 listing, along with a publicly accessible database that maps connections to the wider corporate sector in Canada and globally. The Fossil Power Top 50 is organized in three categories: emitters, corporations based in Western Canada that are directly involved in extracting, processing, and transporting oil, gas, and coal; enablers, organizations that enable fossil fuel production, such as banks and industry-friendly regulators; and legitimators, including industry associations, think tanks, lobby groups, business councils, and pro-oil advocacy groups. The full database documents 1,656 organizations, 44,433 people, and it also tracks 53,225 relations between these and is being continually updated. The corporate mapping team consists of almost 80 academic and community-based researchers and advisors from environmental, indigenous, labor, and independent media groups, and the project is hosted by the University of Victoria and jointly led by UVic, the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and the Parkland Institute, together with a large group of partners. You can find the Corporate Mapping Project at corporatemapping.ca.
The federal government will invest $138 million to build two new migrant detention centres in Surrey and in Laval. Each facility is designed to hold 158 migrants and refugees and is being built on Correctional Service of Canada grounds, bordering the Leclerc prison. On July 15th, the government announced Valdevid Company Construction Tissier Inc. as a general contractor for the prison. CKUT's Amy Lloyd was on site as representatives from local social justice networks called on the company to withdraw from the contract and declared continued resistance to the government's plans. Amy Darwish of Solidarity Across Borders had this to say.
We are located a couple of steps away from the site where the new migrant prison is supposed to be built. This press conference is taking place in the wake of the announcement of a general contractor who will be responsible for the construction of the project, namely Construction Tisseur Inc. It's a small company that's based in Val-David, Quebec. Construction Tisseur likes to boast about its mandate for social responsibility, its so-called environmentally friendly projects. However, this is not a project like all others. In accepting this contract, Construction Tisseur Inc. is profiting from the detention and deportation of migrants. There's been a lot of attention recently to the struggles of migrants in detention in the United States, where many have spoken openly about them being concentration camps. It's important to remember that Canada also imprisons migrants. Canada also separates families. There are many families who find themselves in the impossible position of having to decide whether they bring their children into prison with them or whether they risk being deported without them. In 2017-2018, there were 144 children who found themselves behind prison walls. As the current plans for the new detention center include a family area as well as a playground surrounded by a 6-foot tall fence, I think it goes without saying that as long as Canada continues to detain families, it will detain children as well. So we're here today to send a very clear message. This will not be the site of a future prison. There will not be one more prison here.
The prison is slated for operation in 2021. No official timeline has been publicized. Over 70 organizations have signed a statement promising to work against the construction of the new migrant prison in Laval.
That's it for headlines. We'll be right back.
Premises, premises. Premises, premises. Go back.
You're listening to Groundwire Community Radio News, available online at www.groundwirenews.ca. You just heard LAL with Belong. Now, it's time for our feature stories. A national billboard campaign to bring attention to murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls ended on June 30th. Robin Erickson and Kiara Reed of CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby spoke to Linda Dobbin-Turner, a board member for Artists Against Racism, the organization that mounted the campaign. Linda centers the importance of October's inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in Winnipeg. We also hear from Matthew Jefferson, whose relative was one of the missing and murdered.
Artists Against Racism was founded in the early 90s, and Lisa Cherry, who is still our executive director, was one of the founders, as well as a couple of friends she had that were very involved in the music community in the Toronto area. They began collecting people that would stand up against racism as a cause. And so they've been working on that for, well, almost over 20 years now, close to 25. And it was initially created to target youth in schools because as adults or older adults, racism can be so deeply ingrained. But the belief is if we can reach younger people and get them thinking and having those conversations and recognizing that it's really a man-created issue, a man done created with knowledge and wisdom and understanding. But I know that the initial organizers, their focus for a lot of years was on the challenges with the Jewish population or the black population, because that's really maybe more what they saw. And I've been pushing for a while that we need to include Indigenous issues, because that to me is the heart of what we experience most of here. So this year, we decided to put a call out across Canada through different ways to try and connect with Indigenous artists. And the first round was really in March, and it was just focusing on Indigenous art that would show just the culture and the spirituality. And a lot of that came in was the missing and murdered women's issues and problems. But I had actually just gone into Winnipeg for the final report that was being shared there after the National Indigenous Women Inquiry was completed, and I said to Lisa, like, we had so much art that really focused on that. I think it's a prime time to bring this issue and just highlight that because it really needs to be kept at the forefront.
My name is Matthew Jefferson. I'm Wet'suwet'en First Nations from northwestern British Columbia. My aunt Frances Brown went missing October 14th, 2017, almost 1 year from today. And I'm here in Winnipeg, Manitoba, currently.
You're present at these hearings. Can I get any of your thoughts about what you've seen and heard so far this week?
There's been a lot of information shared from all over the country, various organizations and people with different stories. Basically what I've witnessed is atrocities to our people across the entire country in different aspects of life and different means of legal justice or injustice. That's sort of what I've been privy to.
What do you say with the merits of this particular process that we're witnessing this week?
We're all like-minded people that want to see change, and we want to do the work to make that change happen. So to have all these people from all over the country with the same mind, the same goal, the same hope, to have them all under the same roof working together, you know, none of this boundary business, no borders, just people, that's huge, it's paramount.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about how this this week has been helpful to you personally?
It's opened my eyes a lot, actually, to just how much is going on inside this entire country, things that I wouldn't have been able to know unless I was here. So to have my eyes opened and to have my heart opened as well has been paramount. It's made me a much more humble person, slightly angrier, but, you know, it's all about productive means to a peaceful resolution to all these issues.
So we looked through the art that we had, and there was so much fabulous art that was pertaining to that. So we focused that for the week. In some places, we managed to get 2 weeks worth of billboards to highlight that art and that topic. It was targeted more to cities that were more of the issue. So Winnipeg, Regina, Saskatoon, Thunder Bay, Vancouver for sure, and even some billboards. I think we got one in Prince George, Edmonton and Calgary as well. I think we had also Montreal and Toronto. But it is tough to judge whether you're making an impact or not. Somebody had commented, like, why are you putting a billboard here? We know it's a problem. But we also know that somebody knows. People know that aren't telling. So maybe if you can keep poking at that little sore, eventually somebody will come forward and say, I know a little bit about so-and-so, but that is the hope, too. If everything unfolds as it is, too, that we have the new national holiday on September 30th, we'd like to run another campaign at that time. And I believe, you know, I think it was the Truth and Reconciliation that requested, or it was one of their recommendations, that we create a holiday. And so I'm not sure. I think for me, if we do something around that line, it would be to use some of the art that focuses more on maybe some of the residential school outcomes. But that is our hope, to do something around September 30th.
That report was courtesy of Robert Erickson and Kiara Reed of CJSF, as well as Michael Welsh of CKUW. CJSF broadcasts on the unceded territories of Musqueam, Squamish, Kwikwetlem peoples. Downtown residents and community groups are opposing a Toronto-based developer's purchase of Portage Place Mall in downtown Winnipeg. They demand that the project be halted until residents have been adequately consulted about the proposal. Selling the land will prevent residents from accessing inner-city resources. For many Winnipeggers, Portage Place not only serves as a mall, but acts as a valuable community space. Plans for the sale were brought forth in a Winnipeg City Council meeting on Thursday, June 18th. CKUW News Coordinator Michael Welsh spoke to community members in attendance about what is at stake in the sale of Portage Place for both downtown Winnipeg and for the city.
I grew up at Portage Place. My mom used to always take us there. Portage Place is like one of the only places you'll hear tons of different languages, Indigenous languages, just spoken over coffee, and I really value that.
Kakike Thundersky was one of eight community members speaking in delegation at a July 18th Winnipeg City Council meeting in opposition to a plan that allows the downtown shopping mall Portage Place and the land under it to end up in the possession of Starlight Investments, a Toronto-based real estate asset management company. These critics noted the multiple uses for the mall and the various ways in which it has become a special gathering place, especially for Indigenous people inside and outside of the city. Consequently, there was outrage about the lack of consultation and the lack of transparency among non-commercial stakeholders.
My name's Kate Schoberg, and I live in Winnipeg. I'd love to hear from urban reserve leaders and know, I'd love to know whether they were approached to talk about what they might be interested in doing with Portage Place. I'd love to know whether major nonprofits or social enterprises were approached to talk about what they'd like to do with the space. I'd love to know whether health entities in the city that could be serving our needs in terms of safe injection sites, in terms of 24-hour safe spaces, were approached to offer those services through Portage Place. Those conversations have not happened. We've been offered one option. The option is to transfer this land to a Toronto developer that has no, there is no accountability to our community in that situation.
Portage Place Shopping Mall is currently owned by Spruceland Mall Limited Partnership. The land on which it was built and the adjoining parking lot and walkways are owned by the Forks North Portage Partnership, a corporation wholly owned by three levels of government. Once the mall and the land come under the control of Starlight Investments, community members are concerned that everything they have built over the years will be offset by faraway commercial interests, not the people of the area. Owen Taves is a Winnipeg-based postdoctoral fellow at the University of Alberta. He's the author of Stolen City, Racial Capitalism, and the Making of Winnipeg.
That's so interesting that city councillors were emphasizing the original intent of the mall. Because, of course, it was one of the key developments of the Core Area Initiative, and the origins of the Core Area Initiative are from the very inspiring grassroots movement in the 70s to move the CPR rail yards that divide the North End from the rest of the city, which came out of opposition to the Sherbrooke-McGregor overpass, which was intended to demolish a big swath of the neighborhood south of the tracks, actually. So that was a movement to preserve the existing housing and schools and other amenities in the inner city against demolition, and then to use that money that would have gone into bridges and overpasses over and under the rail yards for affordable housing and daycares and clinics and parks and other things that people in the inner city actually need.
According to Owen Taves, it was then federal Liberal cabinet minister Lloyd Axworthy who made himself the face of this movement and secured $100 million in federal, provincial, and municipal funding, ostensibly in response to the demands of these residents and advocates.
But then what happened was that Axworthy, because he's a Liberal, took that money and gave it to huge corporate developers to build shopping malls like Portage Place, Winnipeg Square, and the Forks, which is not a traditional shopping mall, but a festival marketplace oriented towards tourists and people with extra money to spend. So to me, those shopping malls actually represent a theft of resources from the people of the inner city. And they represent actually not the original intention of the revitalization initiatives that won that money in the first place.
On the afternoon of July 18th, Winnipeg City Council voted to approve the planned sale. Two other levels of government partnered with the city have yet to signal their approval. From Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabeg-Akin, the homeland of the Métis and the historical territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
Coalition Avenir Quebec's Bill 21 went into effect on June 16, 2019. The bill, referred to as an act preventing the laicity of state, prevents public workers in positions of authority from wearing religious symbols. It also prevents people from receiving public services with their faces covered. The laws will most seriously curtail the freedoms of Muslim women who wear the hijab, Jews who wear the kippah, and Sikhs who wear turbans. Bill 21 invokes the notwithstanding clause of the Canadian Constitution, preventing citizens from challenging the law for violating fundamental rights and freedoms protected by the Canadian Charter. CQUT's Amy Lloyd spoke to Mei Chu, a Montreal-based lawyer, activist, and spokesperson, active in resisting the bill. Chu, a member of the Progressive Chinese of Quebec, recently organized a fast with other protesters to highlight how Bill 21 will impact the employment of religious minorities.
In response to Bill 21, you and others partook in a series of fasts. What was the catalyst behind this decision?
I think one of the catalysts was the refusal to accept that we had no recourse over the passing of one of the most discriminatory and the most Islamophobic law in North America. By using the notwithstanding clause, the government took away charter protection for religious minorities. I would even go as far as to say that Bill 21 is a fascist bill, because not only does it deprive minorities of equal rights protection, but it also provides for a scheme of surveillance and sanctions against people for being religious minorities. The orientation of the CAC is an extension of the ADQ. They're riding on insecurities of the majority of the population who feel like they are losing their identity, who has suffered 15 years of neoliberal cuts from the previous Liberal government. And so people who are vulnerable are looking for scapegoats. And so the CAC handed them a scapegoat. It's a way to detract the majority from the real issue.
Less than 24 hours after it became law, several civil liberty groups filed a constitutional challenge to the act hours after it was enacted, and with it, asked the court for an urgent interim response to suspend the act's operation. The National Council of Canadian Muslims, the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, and Itrak Noorel Haq, a Université de Montréal education student who wears a hijab, are listed as plaintiffs in the case. Honorable Justice Yurgo of the Quebec Superior Court denied the request to suspend operation of the act, stating that it failed to demonstrate that the act would cause harms to those affected, nor that it required urgent interim response. Mustafa Farouk of the National Council of Canadian Muslims has this to say.
We disagree that the harm is hypothetical. As was discussed today at our press conference by Amrit Fire from the World Sikh Organization, she is a student who just graduated from education, and she would have been able to become a teacher. But now, under Bill 21, she can't become a teacher. So the harm isn't hypothetical for her. It's very, very real. And that is the same for many folks right now in Quebec. And we also believe that this stay has to be dealt with in an urgent fashion. In terms of what we're going to keep doing, we're going to keep doing what we've always been doing. We're going to obviously we'll wait for the Quebec Court of Appeal, you know, whether they want to grant our application for leave. But we're always going to be engaging in conversation with our Quebec neighbors. We're going to be, you know, the folks, our NTCM folks in Montreal are going to continue to go and outreach, have coffee, have tea, talk about the real impacts that pieces of legislation like Bill 21 have on them personally. It's really important for folks to understand, even as, you know, governments frame this piece of legislation as, you know, creating a more neutral state, that it's very clear that a neutral state doesn't discriminate.
As of August 1st, the plaintiffs were granted leave to appeal Justice Yurgo's decision. With this decision, the Quebec Court of Appeal has agreed to revisit the question of suspending the operation of the Lay City Law. Reporting for Groundwire, that was CKUT's News Collective. You're still listening to Groundwire Community News, broadcasting from coast to coast to coast and available online at www.groundwirenews.ca. Now, it's time for a community radio report. This episode's community radio report comes from CKUT 90.3 FM in so-called Montreal for Groundwire. The National Campus Radio Association, or NCRA, recently announced a pilot program to nationally syndicate CBC's Front Burner podcast for broadcast at campus community radio stations. The NCRA presents the pilot as a solution for stations struggling to produce original news programming. However, the partnership is raising eyebrows among those long invested in the independence of Canada's community radio sector from state influence. As part of a sector separate from private and public broadcasting, campus community stations across Canada have played a critical role in providing local, grassroots, and leftist programming as an alternative to government-funded media like CBC. So what happens when the programming at a local community station no longer reflects a local community that have otherwise been historically mis- or underrepresented by mainstream media? Groundwire spoke to Amei Ramahatula about how the pilot program affects news programming within the sector. Amei has over 15 years of experience in community radio, as both a producer and news and spoken word coordinator at CHRY Radio in Toronto, and is the founding board member of Community Media Advocacy Center.
I first came across this idea when it was sent on the NCRA listserv, and I was just floored because we don't need CBC News on community radio. It takes away so many of the principles and objectives of community radio. The Canadian broadcast system is built on three sectors: public, private, commercial, and community. So to say that we as community media are just going to give up our capacity to make news to the CBC, to the public sector, is contrary to a broadcast policy. So no, it's definitely not a solution. A solution would be the NCRA supporting projects that allow for capacity within local stations to produce their own community local news. When you get news from the CBC, it's not empowering the community radio station. It's not empowering the sector and new volunteers to think about the ways that they present news, but also to think about the ways that they are part of news making. I've always found that important. If we just report the same news that public media or that private commercial media is talking about, we are not producers of news. We are not a sector that's guiding our ideas of news. And that's important, especially now. I think even if you want to say that the CBC is at arm's length of the government, it's government funded. That should raise a red flag automatically, regardless if they claim to have integrity or not. Being funded by the government in a very direct way compromises anything that you can report on. During the time of Stephen Harper, for example, there were bans on what the media could or couldn't say about certain topics. Climate change was one. So the CBC has to fall in line with that, whereas community media has a bit more space to cover these issues. Community radio station after community radio station is just abandoning their news programs. Definitely funding has to do with it. Ideologically, I think at CHOY in particular, there was a disinterest in news. They wanted to see what kind of money they could make. And then also the CRTC changed the requirements of what constitutes local news. So it has to be locally produced, which makes it difficult to collaborate with other stations. I think we're really, as an industry, as a sector, we're really losing grip on why we're here and what our ethics and values are. That is moving us away from community-centered programming, away from social justice programming.
Also included is a comment from award-winning Community News and Public Affairs Programming, previous CKUT's Community News Coordinator and Groundwire co-founder Gretchen King.
As a researcher of nonprofit community radio news practices across Canada, I know that it's a struggle to produce news made by and for our communities. Sustainability is an issue, but that doesn't mean simply carrying CBC. Our communities need news for and by communities, not a Canadian colonial broadcasting system. So it's extremely important to work together to help to sustain community radio news produced by volunteers. Carrying CBC news would be failing our communities, offering them something that they're already getting elsewhere. We need to be providing real alternatives, not simply carrying something produced from the Canadian state's perspective.
That was our community radio report. That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, on the traditional and unceded territory of the Kanekahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Headlines this week were written by Catherine Fisher, Michael Welsh, and Gao Mahadevan. We also thank Michael Welsh, Robert Erickson, Kiara Reed, Amy Lloyd, Ome Ramahatula, and Gretchen Kings for their contributions. I've been your host, Sasha. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download on groundwire.ca. Thanks for tuning in.